You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Lord Jesus, we need your Spirit to open up truth to our eyes. And even then, we miss it. I miss it. So Lord, would your truth be spoken today? Would your truth be heard? And help us to have open ears, open eyes, open hearts to you, your word, and your Spirit afresh this day. In Christ's name, your name. Amen. So this is part two of a four-part class. I don't know if I'll get through all of the key distinctives in Matthew today. If we don't, we'll pick them up next week. And if you don't come back next week, you can listen on the podcast. But last week, it was just sort of mostly introductory stuff. I don't know if anybody went and watched that whole episode of The Chosen or season one. I hope you did. It's a good thing. But today, I want to continue on with talking about what are some of the key distinctives, the key themes that are there in Matthew's gospel. That is, we have four gospels. And some people, I think, find it frustrating, maybe, that we have four. And sometimes people often even want to conflate, particularly Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three Gospels that seen together look so much alike. People sometimes want to conflate them. And I want to say, yes, there's a relationship, particularly between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I think a literary relationship, but they also have distinctives. They have different differences and different angles and different ways that they highlight Jesus and his ministry. And that's to our benefit. It's not sort of a bug in the program. This is a good thing. This is a good thing that we have Matthew, that we have Mark, that we have Luke, and then we have John, which is really easy to see how different John is. But all four of them are different. But last week, I introduced this idea, and I don't know if anybody has ever heard this before, but that there is a literary relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That is, there's sometimes it is word for word in the Greek. You can't kind of think that up on your own when you get word for word kind of order between Matthew, Mark, and Luke at certain places. And my working theory, and this is a theory, but I think it's a pretty good one, is that Mark was likely written first in terms of the Gospels. It's not the first in the New Testament. Likely that's all of Paul's letters were written before any of the Gospels were likely written. But in terms of the Gospels, Mark probably written first. And then Matthew and Luke used Mark as a literary source in front of them as they wrote their Gospels. Okay? It doesn't seem like there's any, that Matthew and Luke don't have any knowledge of each other's Gospels, but they both were likely using Mark as a literary reference point for themselves. Then they all also draw on other material that's probably oral material, stuff that wasn't written down, and that is unique just to Matthew, just to Luke. But the material is, although it's similar content, it is so different in the way that the Greek goes that it wasn't a literary connection, that they were drawing on oral material together to add some things to their Gospels. But then they also frame things uniquely. And I want to talk about some of those distinctives that when we see this, the way that, let's say, Matthew differs from Mark, right? It's not telling a different story of Jesus, but it's different angles, different viewpoints. And how we highlight some of these things. And this is why the handout is a little bit longer than maybe normal, because I just wanted you to make sure you had that stuff in front of you. If you're golfing in the Dominican Republic, too bad. Matthew, though, let's start with, like, how does he use Mark's gospel and to kind of frame things? Well, to begin with, I just want to say that Matthew, he includes most of Mark's material, except, and then I gave you the exceptions. There's a few things that Matthew omits that's in the Gospel of Mark that he just decides to omit for whatever reason. And I give you the list of those things, the demoniac and the synagogue in Capernaum, etc. There's at least six, at least, chunks that Matthew omits. He just does. But then he follows Mark's order quite closely. And beginning at Matthew 14, verse 1. And its parallel is in Mark chapter 6, verse 17. There's not a single pericope, not a single kind of episode that is out of Mark's order. Matthew includes everything from Mark 6, verse 17, in his gospel from chapter 14 forward. He includes it all. There's a few things that are a little bit different in order. For example, the summary of Jesus' ministry at the end of chapter 4 in Matthew and Mark. In Mark, it's at the end of what Jesus was doing in Galilee. In Matthew, it's at the beginning. There's some minor differences, but for the most part, Matthew just follows Mark from that point on. He condenses Mark's narratives by about 25 to 50%. He condenses them, but he keeps 70% of Mark's words in what he retains. The basic differences with Mark is, one, I think Matthew just offers a more systematic arrangement. Particularly, you can see this in the way that he arranges the teachings of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. Whereas the teachings of Jesus in Matthew are kind of not scattered, but they're kind of they're distributed throughout the Gospel in various ways. In Matthew's Gospel, all of Jesus' teaching gets piled up into five teaching blocks, which again makes sense if he's writing this to Jewish Christians who are used to five blocks of teaching in the Pentateuch, right? And he kind of organizes the teachings into five big blocks. And he also includes, of course, a birth narrative. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week. But he includes a birth narrative, as does Luke. But the narratives are very, very different from one another. What are Matthew's theological interests, though? What can we discern as we pay attention to some of the differences there? It appears that in many ways, and I don't know if this excites you, it excites some people, and others it's like puts them to sleep. If I say Matthew is more like a teaching manual than a radical revolutionary tract, I don't know if that excites you or bores you, but there you go. But several things point in this direction that Matthew is intended to be used. Like, you can use it for catechism. You can use it to teach people with, right? Matthew 28, for example, where Jesus says to the disciples after the resurrection, make disciples, teaching them to observe, right? Teaching them. The systematic arrangement of Matthew's gospel, especially, as I said, the great teaching materials into their five great blocks, again, I think indicates that he's intending to kind of provide some systematic way of teaching. In chapters 5, 6, and 7, what we call the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, this is really about the ethics of the kingdom. He begins with telling us who we are. You're blessed. You're blessed. You're blessed. You're salt. You're light. And then, given that if that's who we are, how then do we live? And that's what really occupies most of his teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. Chapter 10, this other great teaching block, the second one, missionaries of the kingdom. What should define these missionaries and what should they be doing? Then chapter 13, he describes the kingdom, how that kingdom message, that proclamation is in the world, and how that sort of divides those who are inside and those who are outside of that story. Chapter 18, the fourth great kind of teaching block in the Gospel of Matthew, talks about church discipline. And it's actually one of only two places in the entire Gospel of Matthew where the word church, ecclesia, is actually used. It's the only gospel that even uses the word church in it. But twice it's used in Matthew, chapter 16, chapter 18. And then chapters 23 through 25, this great cataclysmic description of judgment and warning. And each one of those teaching blocks ends with the same kind of concluding formula. So, for example, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, right, just before the kind of the next movement happens, in chapter 7, verse 28, this is after the Sermon on the Mount, it says, "And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes." And that kind of language, "and when Jesus finished these sayings," occurs five times at the end of the first teaching block, at the end of the second, third, fourth, etc. So I think Matthew's intentional, putting in these markers. A few other factors indicate that the teaching has deep pastoral concern. Like Matthew has ongoing concern for the life of the church. It's not just telling us stuff from the past, but it's for us. It's for the church that he was writing and, I think, continuing for us, which stands against, particularly in his day, if he's writing to primarily Jewish Christians, there still is a Pharisaism that's there on the outside, on the edges. And there's also seems to be a bit of a mixed community there on the one hand, and he's writing to speak to Jewish Christians who still hear Pharisee voices, so to speak. But he's also writing to a church that's beginning to get Gentiles pulled into it as well. So as I said, Matthew alone uses the word church. He's the only gospel writer who does. And both passages that he uses it in, chapter 16, verse 18, chapter 18, verse 17, both passages reflect interests about the church, its leadership, discipleship. A few other factors that kind of, you know, flesh out this pastoral concern. He talks about the role of the disciples, as does Mark and Luke. But instead, in Mark's gospel, over and over again, the disciples are presented as being ignorant about what Jesus is about. That they don't always understand. Jesus is telling them about the nature of discipleship, and they kind of, huh? Like they just don't get it, right? But in Matthew's gospel, one of the things that's really different about that portrayal of the disciples is that instead of not getting it, he actually presents them as models for discipleship. For example, he tends to tone down or even eliminate altogether suggestions that they were men of fear or ignorance or hardness of heart. Not always, but some of the time. So, for example, if you opened up Mark 4, verse 13, and compared it with Matthew 13, verses 16 through 18, in Mark, it says, after their questions about the parables, Jesus says, "Do you not know this parable? How then will you understand all the parables?" So in Mark's gospel, it's like, "Don't you understand?" And the implied answer is, "No." Matthew, though, recasts that same setting and that same situation to become a contrast between disciples and unbelieving Jews. So, in Matthew 13, in verse 10, he says to the disciples, the disciples ask him, "Why do you speak to them, to the unbelieving Jews? Why do you speak to them, not just to us, to them in parables?" And then verse 11, Jesus replies, "To you, my disciples, it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven. But to them," he says, "it has not been given." And then in verse 12, about those who have, those who have not. And then in verse 14 and 15 in Matthew 13, he continues by quoting Isaiah. And he says, Isaiah is being fulfilled. "This people," those outsiders, so to speak, "their hearts have grown dull." But then he says, to finish off this little section, he says in verses 16 and 17 of Matthew 13, he says, "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear." And so he begins then the parable of the sower. You hear then this parable. So I don't know if that helps, but that's just one example of how Matthew recasts the disciples as those who understand, those who are models for discipleship. Another one in Matthew 13 as well, verse 36 through to kind of the end of the chapter. Let's just maybe open up and just read that moment here. Chapter 13, beginning in verse 36. So this is the parable of the weeds being explained. It says, "Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples come around him." Right? They're coming to lean in, to hear a little bit more. "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field." And he answered, and then he kind of told what this parable meant. But then when he gets to verse 51, Have you understood all these things? And what do they say? Yes, we do. We understand this. In Mark's gospel, do you understand all these things? In Mark chapter 6, verse 52, it says, they did not understand. But you see what I'm doing here? Like trying to explain how in Mark, they repeatedly don't understand, but in Matthew, there are times where they do. And I think this is a mark of some of the things that Matthew is doing slightly different. And there's other examples as well. Even this morning, we heard the Transfiguration story in Matthew 17, verse 4, where what does Peter do? He actually gets what's going on in Matthew's presentation, you know, of the Transfiguration. Matthew presents Peter as going, hey, appropriately, I should build booths, some tents for you. But in Mark's gospel, at the Transfiguration, the same moment, Peter's like, I don't know what's going on here. A little different. Peter seems to understand. He goes, it is good for us to be here. Not, what are we doing here? All right. Matthew 10, in contrast to Mark 6, the sending out of the 12 is expanded in Matthew 10 to idealize the role of the missionary in Matthew's church. So he expands how they should be going out as missionaries. Preach as you go, he says in Matthew. Heal the sick. None of this stuff is in Mark. There's a further collection of sayings, and then they're given a commission. Although Matthew has manifest concern for the Gentile mission, he also shows great concern over continuity with Israel's past. And this is why he includes things like a genealogy to start his gospel. He has overt Jewish interests and character. Only to the house of Israel kind of stuff, right? The promise fulfillment formula in Matthew's gospel. So at 11 times in the gospel of Matthew, Matthew says, this is written in order to fulfill what has been written. Matthew emphasizes that fulfillment. This is to fulfill that which has been written. Okay? So he's got this pastoral concern that expresses itself in discipleship questions, which Matthew emphasizes over and over again as a discipleship where Christ is the new Torah. Jesus is the new law, who has come not to do away with that, but to fulfill all that it was pointing to. So the end of Matthew, he says, go and teach them to observe what? All that I have commanded you. Observe that. So in the Sermon on the Mount, we've got this abiding validity of the law to some degree. I've come not to abolish or destroy, but to fulfill. Right? He says in Matthew chapter 10, verse 19, Mark chapter 10, he says, you know the commandments. But in Matthew, he says, if you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments and love, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? Keep the commandments. And this is striking in Matthew. And the whole thing is, how do we keep them? There is no way we can keep them if we have a righteousness like that of the scribes and the Pharisees. It's impossible to keep them. We can only keep them if Christ fulfills. If Christ is the new righteousness. And if Christ delivers on what Jeremiah promised, that we need new hearts. We need what Ezekiel says. We need the Spirit. And Jesus fulfills this. And he gives us not just sort of new commandments that almost seem to out Moses. I mean, really, right? Huh? I mean, you've heard it been said that you shouldn't kill. And most of us go, okay. Most of you aren't ice hockey players, so that's fine. But Jesus then says, don't be angry. And you're like going, come on now. How do I do that? I mean, he seems to like be upping the ante. And Jesus is saying, you can only do that if I fulfill this law and if you receive the Spirit as well. Right? So, thus the law, in its new expression, is to be taught. And it requires obedience. And I love that, that word. Sometimes people go, obedience. That doesn't fire me up to get up in the morning with a lot of joy. But it comes from a word that means to hear. Odier. To hear. Hear. Hear this. Let it enter your ear. We have eyelids, but we don't have ear lids. Let it enter. Let it enter our heart. This word afresh, right? Hear, O Israel. Not see, O Israel. Hear, O Israel. Hear. So Matthew, he's writing to a Jewish audience. I think that's pretty clear. But he's also writing to maybe those who might think, well, if Jesus fulfills the law, then to heck with the law. We can act however we want. And he's kind of fighting on a couple fronts there, against the lawlessness and against the Pharisaic understanding of the law. That is, I have to do this. I have to pull myself up. I have to keep the law. And Jesus is saying, no, I do. But he's also speaking against those who might say, we can live however we want, which was, frankly, a real problem for Paul, particularly in that church in Corinth. Jesus must be obeyed. Nonetheless, we hear this, that his yoke, unlike the yoke of the scribes and the Pharisees, his yoke is easy. His burden is light. And that's why we have on our bulletin every single Sunday that saying, come unto me. Come, walk with me. Get put in the yoke with me. It's a yoke that fits. It's not going to chafe. It's not going to wear you down. Walk with me. Learn of me. Eugene paraphrases this. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I love that expression. So, Matthew's doing some different things. Pause for a moment. Is that disturbing or is that kind of helpful? Well, maybe it's both, actually. I don't know. Any massive question? You're like, Pinter, huh? Yeah.
Your distinction between Matthew and Mark, the way mm-hmm. you describe the parables, understanding, seems a little self-serving on Matthew's part.
Yeah.
Is that maybe part of the book?
Could be, yeah. I mean, it's so hard. Like, you have to, I think, place it within the whole scope. Like, he's doing this in multiple places, not just here. You know, not just in that moment. Self-serving in the sense of, like, put your hand up, turn around, and do one of these.
Yeah.
Could be, but he does it so consistently that I guess the question is why, and I think he's doing it to present. Here's a model. If you want to know what it looks like, do this. And so when it comes to the parables, lean in and try to understand. Jesus is actually telling us what the answer is, anyways. So I don't know. It could be self-serving, but it's so consistent throughout the gospel that I kind of wonder what's going on there. And I think it has to do, in Mark, the disciples, they're not getting it. And I wonder, too, if, like, Mark's audience is likely a Gentile Christian audience living in Rome during massive persecution. This is the Neronic persecutions. But it was a Gentile audience, likely. And if you actually have lived and reflected on the law for a long time, maybe that's part of the angle. Like, as a Jewish Christian, you've heard these stories, and now you're beginning to understand. And hopefully, with the other disciples, I can be a model too. And none of us usually want to say, follow me. I certainly am reluctant to do that, but actually, there are times in the New Testament, Paul says that in Philippians. He goes, be imitators of me, insofar as I am imitating the Lord. That's the that's the catch, insofar as I'm imitating Christ. Yeah. But yeah, self-serving, possibly in some ways, yeah. Self-serving also for the community. Be like this. Here are the models. Follow, often models, yeah. Apparently, I've got like 4 minutes. What can I do in 4 minutes? Oh, let's start this anyways, and we'll continue on if you want to come back next week. Here's just some key aspects about Matthew's portrayal of Jesus. So, as I said, Mark's outline is really clear. Jesus is the suffering servant. But in Mark, this idea of who Jesus is as the suffering servant is a little bit kept secret. It's less visible. But Matthew highlights Jesus' true deity in ways that maybe aren't there in Mark. So, for example, here just... did I put all of this in? The expressions of awe, reverence, worship? This, again, if you want to look this up, see if I'm actually telling you the truth or just faking you out. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 27, after the stilling of the storm, in place of Mark's word, after Jesus stills the storm in Mark chapter 1, and he's in the boat and he's just said, and I hear Jesus shouting, "Be silent!" to the waves. It says in Mark, they had fear. I mean, the waves, the wind goes silent. But in Matthew's gospel, it says they wondered. Or it can also be translated as they worshipped. They worshipped Jesus. So over and over again, there's examples where worship occurs in Matthew that doesn't occur in Mark. The crowds at the healing of the dumb demoniac worship. They're wondering. They're in awe. They're in wonder. The crowd at the healing of the deaf mute in Matthew chapter 15, it says, and this is in addition to Mark 7, and they glorified the God of Israel. They worshipped. The disciples at the withering of the fig tree in Matthew 21 says they worshipped him. They were in awe. Over and over again, there's examples where Matthew adds that in contrast to what Mark does. When things happen, when Jesus does things, they worship. You're only supposed to worship God. And they worship. They're in awe. They worship. The Magi come. Different word for worship. But the Magi come, and what do? At the feet of Jesus, the baby Jesus? Well, I think it's a terrible 2-year-old, frankly. At the feet of this, like, little toddler running around. I mean, have you seen 2-year-olds recently? What they, like, chaos in embodiment, right? I mean, it's this toddler Jesus, the Magi worship. The lepers in Matthew 8 worship. Mark, it just says they kneel, or he kneels. Jairus, after his daughter was healed, in Mark it says, he fell at Jesus' feet. But in Matthew it says, Jairus fell down and worshipped. Worshipped. Right? Just this over and over again. The women at the tomb in Matthew chapter 28, the women at the tomb worship the risen Lord. They didn't just fall at his feet, they worshipped. The disciples worshipped him. At the end of chapter 28, after seeing Jesus. But I also love this note in Matthew, and he adds this, and we'll finish with this for today. The risen Jesus, they see him, and it says they worshiped him. And then the next phrase is hilarious, I think. But some doubted. I was like, I just want to kind of cuff them in the back of the head there for that one. You're kidding me. You know, raised from the dead, vindication of Israel. Anyways. We'll pick some of this stuff up as we go through a little bit more in Matthew's gospel. I hope this has been fun. Oh, yes. Yeah, sir.
Yeah, I was actually looking at the worship.
Did I get it wrong?
No. I was just comparing it basically from what when Matthew describes it worshiping, and most commonly Mark says falling at his feet. I think with that worship, that kind of connects to the conviction you feel.
Sure. Yeah, and kneeling at feet could be worship, could be, but it doesn't have to be. And I just think Matthew kind of expands that. It says they knelt and worshipped. There's some times I feel like falling at the feet of Belen for his just, he's amazing, you know, but it doesn't necessarily mean I'm worshiping him. You know, I guess Matthew's just sort of, he's sort of drawing that out, yeah, that it's just, it's a little bit more, so, and it's making it explicit. I don't know if that helps. Bless you, friends. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.